You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, October 18, 2017.
Commissioner Fish specifically quoted the Old Testament. It's actually a quote that had to do with locusts and pestilence, and suggested that while he didn't know of any other public options, that this was an option: prayer for the wicked.
WFHB News Director Wes Martin talks with Indiana Recovery Alliance Director Chris Abert about Bedford's decision to discontinue their needle exchange program. That story coming up later for our Daily Local News Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, flare-lit tip-offs, or how to identify when an imposter wants your information for nefarious purposes. That's coming up on a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, these are your daily headlines.
Richland Bean Blossom Community School Corporation is enjoying the success of system-wide efforts to improve its state ranking. RBB recently received straight A's in its report card from the Indiana Department of Education. In the school board's meeting on Monday, school board member Dana Kerr summed up RBB's efforts.
One thing that you hear as a concern of corporations is that kids fall through the cracks. We don't have cracks. There are not cracks at RBB. We catch all the students.
In a presentation to board members, Edgewood Primary School Principal Brenda Whitaker said her teachers track each of her school's 600 students' academic progress individually and devise tactics for improvement.
So we know where every student is performing in math and in reading. And when the students are not performing well, perhaps they've flatlined or perhaps they're going down, then we have intense discussions about what we can do to bring that performance up.
As an example, Whitaker says in February 2016, teachers noticed their first and second graders weren't progressing as fast as they should.
The data is down to a science, and students have to gain at least 2 words per week to stay at what we call benchmark, or what we know they need to be in order to succeed at the next level of learning. And they weren't.
Though teachers were already doing targeted interventions, Whitaker says they realized they had to do more to help students improve before spring ISTEP testing began. They agreed to institute an intensive one-on-one tutoring program before and after school.
Not every single parent agreed to come, but most did, and the teachers stepped up and they gave that time. Some of it started at 7:45 in the morning, and we'd go until the start of school, and then we'd start right after school and go till about 4 in the afternoon. And what we saw with first grade in February, we had 72% of our students at benchmark. By the end of that time of intense tutoring, and when we gave those benchmarks, first grade had grown from 72% to 86%. That's a 14 percentage point growth.
Whitaker says second graders improved with intensive tutoring.
Those second graders, there were about 78% of our second graders who were benchmarked, and after our tutoring, that grew to 88%. So that's just a little snapshot of some of the things we do to try to meet the needs of every single student and to make sure that we're seeing growth across the board all the way through the year.
Edgewood Intermediate School Principal Jennifer Lee says her team does similar work to improve student math scores by focusing on kids in the bottom quarter percentile.
We not only pushed them a grade level, but we pushed them above a grade level's worth of growth. And we were so incredibly proud to see that. As I mentioned in the last board meeting, math was definitely one of our weaknesses. It has been a weakness at EIS, and it's really something that we targeted as a corporation as being a weakness. And so we have put so much time and effort into improving our instructional strategies to make sure that we're reaching all of those kiddos. But to see that bottom 25%, that really hit home for us, that the kiddos that sometimes have the least amount of support at home, that we're doing even more for them at school.
Assistant Superintendent Dr. Jerry Sanders explained the school corporation's grades are based not only on current ISTEP data, but also on comparisons to previous year's ISTEP data to determine student growth in English, language, arts, and math proficiencies. Beginning in the spring of 2019, ISTEP will be replaced with another standardized test dubbed iLearn, which is still being developed.
The City of Bloomington is assessing three downtown parking garages for their soundness and long-term viability. The Board of Public Works approved a $147,000 contract with CE Solutions to conduct structural assessments of the Morton Street Garage, Walnut Street, and 4th Street parking garages. In the board's meeting yesterday, President Kyla Cox-Deckard voiced her support for the study to Public Works Director Adam Wason.
I'll just comment that I'm not sure excited is the right word, but I'm glad that this is going to be happening soon and that we'll have some really good information to make decisions on related, especially to the 4th Street Garage.
Yes, especially in regards to the 4th Street Garage. We need to know basically the cost-benefit analysis of the overall life of the garage compared to potentially looking at a new structure at some point. So that's something that's very important to us. I think it's a 30-year-old garage at 31-year-old garage at this point. Maybe hasn't had all the maintenance it should have had over the years, so that'll be an important part of the study.
Wason also sought approval for additional repairs to the 30-year-old skywalk connecting the 4th Street Garage to Fountain Square Mall.
We had some further investigation done today on some condensation buildup and some rusting of some of the steel trusses and posts. So we're looking at potentially having a much larger issue to address.
Ryan Daly, parking garage manager, says the water accumulation wasn't initially apparent until repair crews stripped the carpet from the skywalk walls. Daly says leaky skywalk windows are the source of the problem.
We're going to need to assess those windows in that skywalk. Have caulking around them. They have a piece of plastic layer around the outside, like most windows do. Mm-hmm. Those have seen 30 years of sunlight, expansion, contraction, and many of those pieces have shrunk. And that's where a majority of the water is coming in, through the sides of those windows, mm-hmm. into the bay. I don't know if you've seen the photographs of those steel columns. Yeah. All that water drains down on the side of there, rusts up that column. Any work that we would do in that walkway would not be guaranteed if we had any water go through that window. Our warranties would be voided after that point. So we're going to need to look at taking those windows out, cleaning them up, and just resealing all of those. Almost every one of them will need to be resealed.
Daly says repair crews will move forward to drain and re-anchor the skywalk columns, but the Public Works Department is still gathering bids for the window repair project. Wason said these additional repairs put the skywalk renovation on a tight timeline, but he still aims to have it open for the holiday shopping season.
13 Indiana counties will soon receive art consultants. Anderson, Batesville, Burns Harbor, Greenfield, Logansport, Muncie, Plymouth, Rising Sun, Rockville, Rushville, South Bend, Terre Haute, and Nashville will receive artist consultants to help with community art projects. The National Association of Counties Director of Marketing and Communications, Rex Van Sant, says community members attended workshops earlier in the year before applying for grants to have artist consultants placed in their communities. Van Sant says consultants help each community fulfill their needs.
It really depends on what the community has in mind, and if the community really needs more guidance on what direction they should go, then that's what we would find a consultant that had that kind of experience as well. And then they would come in, meet with the community, and they would try to get some feedback from community leaders, the public, and then sit down with those individuals and say, this is what the recommendation is. This is where we think your strengths are going to be, and the way to develop a more promising, successful plan to use the arts in your community development project.
Van Zandt says each community has given up to $2,500 to cover expenses for the planning process. Indiana Art Commission Artist and Community Services Manager Anna Trugesser says the consultants will assist with public art projects.
So each community needs something different. They're all unique. So they've all been paired with consultants who have different experiences. There's a lot of different things that could come out of this. In general, creative placemaking is a process or a tool that communities can use to address a whole variety of different problems or things they want to see happen. Typically, it involves using artists or creative people or creative resources and assets in a public place in order to make community feel stronger or more vibrant.
More information about the Community Arts Program is available online at in.gov/arts.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie will be in Indianapolis on October 30th to give the keynote address at the 8th Annual Prescription Drug Abuse and Heroin Symposium. Governor Christie is the chair of President Trump's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. The symposium is the largest statewide collaboration of experts on drug abuse and law enforcement. Speakers and guests will include professionals from local, state, and federal agencies, law enforcement, academia, clinicians, and treatment counselors, among experts from other fields. The event is being hosted by Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill and the Office of the Attorney General. The symposium begins at 9 a.m. on October 30th and will continue until 3 p.m. on the 31st. Governor Christie's speech begins at 3 p.m. October 30th at the Sheraton Hotel in Indianapolis. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Yesterday, the Lawrence County Commissioners voted to end their needle exchange program. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Chris Abert, Director of the Indiana Recovery Alliance, about the decision. Abert says the program was free to Lawrence County, whose seat is Bedford, and that program saved 52 lives over the last year.
Chris Abert, thank you very much for speaking with us. Can you talk a little bit about what happened yesterday in Lawrence County, what happened in Bedford and with the Lawrence County commissioners with regards to the attempt to shut down the needle exchange program that is operated by the Indiana Recovery Alliance in Lawrence County?
The short of it is that the two of the commissioners, at least, in choosing to not second the motion, abandoned people who are struggling to die. In doing that, Commissioner Fish specifically quoted the Old Testament. It's actually a quote that had to do with locusts and pestilence, and suggested that while he didn't know of any other public options, that this was an option, prayer for the wicked.
And so it sounds like that commissioner ended up seeing people addicted to heroin or people addicted to other substances as a kind of pestilence that had descended upon Lawrence County.
That's the way the Bible quote reads. Our main objection, I mean, there are many objections to that, but to have public health policy driven by interpretations of Old Testament verses seems not very wise nor compassionate. We think that there are other readings that would suggest
that Christians might minister to the sick, might love those who are cast to the least positions in society, and welcome and love people.
And can you explain for our listeners exactly what happened in Lawrence County yesterday?
So we started there about a year ago. In that year, we signed a contract, and the contract didn't have any financial incentive for us. And we had hoped we would go back. We knew that we would have to renew the contract after a year. So when we went back to renew, our plan was to inform them, you know, that 52 overdoses had been reported. So that's 52 people who might otherwise have died, didn't in Lawrence County. And also that their hepatitis C rates, from preliminary numbers, at least from the Indiana State Department of Health, had been halved. So it went from about 188 per 100,000 to, I believe, 89 per 100,000, just in 1 year. So we had expected actually to go in there and maybe even be congratulated for the work that we had done, the lives that we had saved, and perhaps get some financial assistance. Instead, we went in there and were met with rhetoric and moral condemnation, judgment for people who use drugs, and as far as I could see, just a lack of compassion for the issue. Six or seven people stood up, including doctors, academics, public servants, experts in the field, and citizens, and expressed their support for, you know, harm reduction in general. One person expressed dismay, the prosecutor, and in fact went so far as to suggest that people who use drugs that were concerned about their health could go to Rural King and get their syringes there, which, if anyone goes to Rural King, those are livestock syringes, completely inappropriate for human use. And the implications of, I just don't understand, dehumanizing in a new level, right? Suggesting that people could use livestock instruments. So that's what happened. It's unfortunate. It shows how deep the stigma is. It shows how criminalization of drug users, ultimately leads to policies that increase death and infection. And this is for the whole community is going to suffer from this. Unfortunately, public health doesn't compartmentalize itself. So while we can other people, we can't other public health. This will affect the community as a whole.
And Chris, what can you tell our listeners about kind of the state of affairs when it comes to primarily opioid addiction in Lawrence County, which includes Bedford? What can you tell us about what it is that looks like on the ground, and what are the people that you end up working with? You had mentioned 52 cases of overdoses that had been treated by Indiana Recovery Alliance.
Sure. So I can definitely address that Lawrence County was 15th in the state for hepatitis C prevalence. And what we know about that, according to the Center for Disease Control, is that is the key indicator for likelihood of an HIV outbreak, such as happened in Scott County. Now, attendant with that hepatitis C rates are of course, increased overdose rates throughout the state. We also know that the fastest growing population of IV drug use is between 15 and 24-year-old white rural youth, and also the fastest growing population of new hepatitis C infections is among that same group. So the profile is there. Lawrence County certainly meets the hepatitis C epidemic qualifications. And it is literally not a if it's going to get worse, but when and how much. Overall, experts tend to think that by 2021, 500,000 people will have died just from opiate overdose. What we're trying to do is diminish that, right? We're trying to reduce the amount of death and infection. We have solid evidence that shows that our program does that. Lawrence County is most definitely at risk for even more severe public health and economic consequences. The only scientific data-driven program that we know of that addresses that, that didn't cost them any money at all, was unceremoniously denied to continue its operation based on moral indignation.
And Chris, you end up talking a lot about what the Indiana Recovery Alliance does is harm reduction. Can you explain what harm reduction is and what is the point of harm reduction services or harm reduction tactics when it comes to combating epidemic spreads of things like hepatitis C and HIV outbreaks?
Sure. It's a very simple idea. Harm reduction suggests that we should move towards any positive change. And what I mean by that is that for example, we have about around 2,000 participants. So if we can get each of those participants to make small positive health changes in their lives, those will have cumulative effects, not only for their individual health, but also for the community as a whole.
So what would be one of those positive changes that you would expect a community member that is in contact with the Indiana Recovery Alliance? What would end up being a positive effect of a harm reduction technique?
So a positive effect would be understanding transmission of hepatitis C and the various routes that it might take. So learning about the epidemiological necessity of handing out cookers and tourniquets and waters, because those are also modes of transmission for disease, that's harm reduction in the educational sense. Actually supplying people with clean syringes and instructing them on how to be safe, giving out naloxone and preventing death. You know, even as everything from that all the way to helping people find housing, allowing people to enter into the healthcare system without fear of being judged or having the police called on them, advocating for Good Samaritan laws so people can call 911 without fear of being arrested when their friends are overdosing. All those things are harm reduction. And your listeners, they engage in harm reduction every day. Something as simple as putting a seatbelt on, right? So driving a car is an inherently risky choice that we make every day. And we can mitigate some of those negative health outcomes by wearing a seatbelt.
That was Indiana Recovery Alliance Director and Founder Chris Abert speaking with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about Lawrence County's decision to cancel their syringe exchange program. More of that interview is available online at WFHB.org.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
A flare-lit tip-off is an obvious red flag, something that stands out like a searchlight in the night, warning you that something is not right, begging you to be suspicious. The phrase is fairly common today, but most people don't know it's nearly 100 years old. It was invented by one of the great early science fiction writers, E.E. Doc Smith, whose heroes traveled in spaceships propelled by super-bright flares, and whose vast space opera sagas, the Lensman series, make Star Wars look like flatulence in a teapot. The con games you're most likely to encounter these days usually have at least one flare-lit tip-off built into them, like these. You get a surprise phone call, or an email, or even a text message from somebody who says they're a policeman, a lawyer, a government official, or something like that. Just getting the call is suspicious because official agencies, including the cops, the FBI, the IRS, and all the real authorities, always send you letters in the U.S. Postal Service snail mail before they ever try to contact you by any other means. You get pressured to make a decision quickly. No matter what kind of a deal you're dealing with, anybody who wants you to decide now, and especially anybody who wants you to cough up money right now, is probably a crook. Government officials and legitimate merchants are always willing to give you time to check things out, think things over, or make arrangements before you act. If somebody pushes you to act immediately, push back, or just walk away. You are asked by someone you don't know personally to pay money, especially money to a government organization, by wire transfer or by using a prepaid money card. That's where you buy such a card, and there are lots of them, from Green Dot money cards to iTunes cards or some other gift card, and then give the secret card number to someone so they can take the money. This always means swindle in big red flashing letters. Any legitimate debt you owe can be paid by check, or better yet, by credit card. That way, you can dispute the payment later if it turns out you've been flim-flammed. You are asked to give your personal information, or worse, your bank account information or debit card numbers. If you're dealing with someone you don't know personally, face-to-face, this is almost always a flare-lit tip-off that you're dealing with a fraudster. It might be all right if you're applying for something online, if you're absolutely certain the website is legitimate, and if you've checked out the owners of that website beforehand. Too many people are still being scared or bamboozled into falling for all kinds of rackets, simply because they didn't know how to spot these flare-lit tip-offs. Help spread the word. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester, Wes Martin, and Alex Davis, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Our engineer today is Dan Withard. Our theme music provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program, recognized among the best newscasts in 2016 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned right now for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.